ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So reading from the Jiva Dharma by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So I just have to readjust to not having to wait for somebody to translate. So this first chapter, this is a novel by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And so in this novel, then he writes in all the different important philosophical points that are there in the Vaishnav philosophy, and then he brings them in, you know, one after the other. So it's very logically presented, very technically presented, but done very nicely in a story form. So it's very easy to assimilate. So this first chapter is called Jivir Nitya, O Naimittic Dharma, or the soul's eternal and temporary natures. Of all earthly realms, Jambudvip is the best. Of all places in Jambudvip, Bharatvarsha is the best. Of all places in Bharatvarsha, Gaudadesh is the best. Of all places in Gaudadesh, Sri Navadvip Mandala is the best. In one part of Sri Navadvip Mandala, on the Ganga shore, the beautiful village of Sri Godruma, is splendidly manifest eternally. In ancient times, many Bhajananandi devotees made their homes in the gardens of Sri Godruma. In that place, in a cottage of vines, a Sarabi cow once worshipped Lord Gaurasundara, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Not far from that place was a Bhajan Kutir named Prajumna Kunj. In that Bhajan Kutir, thick with vines, a Paramahamsa Babaji, who was an initiated disciple of the Supreme Lord's personal associate, Prajumna Brahmachari, always stayed, wrapped in the bliss of worshipping the Lord, Bhajanananda. Aware that Sri Godruma is not different from Sri Nandagram in Vrindavan, Sri Premjas Babaji, who was learned in all the scriptures, also took shelter in that holy place. Every day he chanted Lord Hari's names 200,000 times. Every day he offered hundreds and hundreds of dandavat obeisances to all the Vaishnavas. He maintained his life by madhukari begging at the homes of the cowherd people there. He strictly followed the rules of a saintly life. When he had finished all his spiritual duties, he would not waste his time with gossip. Rather, he would read with tears in his eyes. In Prema Varta of Lord Gaurasundara's dear associate, Jagadananda Pandit. At those times, the devotees in that forest grove would listen with love and devotion. And why not? The book Prema Varta is full of the sweet mellows, rasas of devotional service. Also, this Babaji read it so sweetly that hearing its words at once extinguished whatever remained of the poisoned fire of material desires in the hearts of the devotees. One afternoon, when he had finished the chanting of all his rounds, the Paramahamsa Babaji sat down in the Madhavi vine-covered cottage and read from Premavivarta. And as he read, he became plunged in the ocean of devotional love. At that moment, an austere sannyasi approached him and again offered dandavat obeisances at his feet. Plunged in devotional bliss, the Babaji was, for a long moment, unaware of external events. Finally seeing the sannyasi prostrate before him, the Babaji, who was more humble than a blade of grass, at once bowed down to greet him, saying, O Lord Chaitanya, O Lord Nityananda, please be merciful upon me, a fallen soul. The Babaji began to weep. Then the sannyasi said to the saintly Babaji, O Master, I am very lowly and fallen. Why, imitating my actions, do you mock me in this way? Then, taking the dust of the Babaji's feet, the sannyasi sat down before him. Giving the sannyasi a tree bark sitting place, and then sitting beside him, the Babaji, his words choked with spiritual love, said, "O Master, I am a fallen soul. How may I serve you?" Setting down his kamandalu, the regal sannyasi respectfully folded his hands and said, "O Master, I am very unfortunate. I studied the Shankhya, Patanjali, no Patanjala, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Purva Mimamsa, and Uttara Mimamsa philosophies. I studied the Vedanta Upanishads and many other scriptures also. I traveled on pilgrimage to Varanasi and many other holy places. I spent much time debating with others the meaning of the scriptures. It is 12 years now since I accepted a sannyasi danda from Srila Satchidananda Saraswatipad. After I accepted the danda, I spent my time always traveling to all the holy places. Wherever I went in Bharatvarsha, I always associated with the sannyasi followers of Shankara. Passing through the stages of Kutichak, Bahudak, and Hamsa, after a few days, I attained the stage of Paramahamsa. Then I stayed always at Varanasi. Observing a vow of silence, I took shelter of the saying, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahma. Pragyanam Brahma, Brahma is consciousness. And Tattvamasi, you are that. Which Shankara declares are the Mahavakyas, most important statements of the scriptures. Then one day, a saintly Vaishnava, singing songs about Lord Hari's pastimes, came before me. Opening my eyes wide, I gazed at him. He was bathed by the tears flowing from his eyes, and the hairs of his body stood erect in ecstasy. In a choked voice, he chanted, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda. Again and again, he danced with faltering steps. Sometimes he fell to the ground. As I gazed at him and heard his song, my heart became filled with love, a love I have no power to describe. Even though I became filled with love, I followed the rules of Paramahamsa life, and I did not speak a word to him. I am pathetic. My rules of Paramahamsa life are pathetic. And my so-called good fortune is also pathetic. Why did I not speak to him? Since that day, my heart has been irresistibly drawn to the feet of Sri Chaitanya. I became very agitated. I spent many days searching for that Vaishnava, but I did not see him anywhere. When I saw that Vaishnava and heard the holy names from his mouth, I became filled with a pure and sacred bliss. Before that time, I did not know that such a bliss existed anywhere. I did not think it was possible for a human being to experience such bliss. After some days of thinking, I decided that it would be best for me to take shelter of the feet of a Vaishnava. Then I left Varanasi and went to Sridham Vrindavan. There I saw many Vaishnavas. Every one of them was calling out the names, O Sri Rupa, O Sri Sanatana, O Sri Jiva Goswami, and lamenting. They were all meditating on Sri Sri Radha Krishna's pastimes, and in voices choked with love, calling out the name of Navadvip. From that moment, I have yearned to see Navadvip. After a 168-mile journey from Sri Vrajadham, I arrived in Mayapur a few days ago. In Mayapur town, I heard of your glories, and so now I have come to take shelter of your feet. Please be merciful to me, accept me as your servant, and give my story an ending that is good. Weeping again and again, and humbly placing a blade of straw between his teeth, the saintly Paramahamsa said, O saintly sannyasi, I am very unfortunate. I fill my belly, I sleep, I speak useless gossip, and in this way I have wasted my life. Now I pass my days in the place where Sri Krishna Chaitanya enjoyed his pastimes. Still I have no power to taste what is true love for Lord Krishna. You are fortunate, gazing at a Vaishnav, for a moment you tasted that love. You have received the mercy of Lord Krishna Chaitanya. If when you taste pure spiritual love, you once remember this fallen person, my life will be a great success. Speaking again and again in this way, the saintly Babaji tightly embraced the saintly sannyasi and bathed him with the tears flowing from his eyes. Touched by a Vaishnava, the saintly sannyasi felt an emotion he had never known before. He danced and wept. As he danced, he sang this verse. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Shri Prabhu Nityananda, Jaya Shri Prema Dasa, Guru Jaya Bhajanananda. Glory to Shri Krishna Chaitanya, glory to Lord Nityananda, glory to my spiritual master, Shri Prema Das, glory to the bliss of devotional service. After a long time of chanting and dancing, the two of them talked about many things. Saintly Prema Das, Babaji, humbly said, O great soul, please stay in this Prajumna Kunj for some days and purify me. The saintly sannyasi replied, I place my body in the service of your feet. What to speak of a few days, I will serve you to the end of my life. That is my wish. The saintly sannyasi was learned in all the scriptures. He well knew the spiritual benefit to be attained by staying in the spiritual master's home and studying under his guidance. Therefore, he very happily stayed for some days in that forest grove. After some days, the Paramahamsa Babaji said, O great soul, Sri Prajumna Brahmachari Thakur kindly keeps me at his feet. Today he is wrapped in the worship of Lord Nrisimha in the village of Devapali, in the outskirts of Navadvip Mandal. When we have finished our Madhukari begging for alms, let us go and see him. The saintly sannyasi replied, As you order, so I shall do. Crossing the Alakananda River, the two of them came to Devapali at 2 in the afternoon. Then crossing the Suryatil River, they saw the Supreme Lord's personal associate, Sri Prajumna Brahmachari, in the temple of Lord Nrisimha. From a distance, the Paramahamsa Babaji offered dandavat obeisances to his spiritual master. Melting with love for the Lord's devotees, the saintly Brahmachari at once left the temple. With both hands lifted up, the Paramahamsa Babaji affectionately embraced him and inquired about his welfare. After a long talk about spiritual matters, the Paramahamsa Babaji introduced the saintly sannyasi. The saintly Brahmachari respectfully said, You have attained a proper spiritual master. You should learn Prema Vaivarta from Prema Das. It is said, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila 8.128, Kiva Vipra Kiva Nyasi Shudra Kene Nai Jay Krishna Tattva Veta Se Guru Hoy. Whether one is a Brahman, sannyasi, or Shudra, regardless of what he is, he can become a spiritual master if he knows the science of Krishna. Then the saintly sannyasi humbly offered dandavat obeisances to his Parama Guru, the spiritual master of his spiritual master, and said, O Master, you are a personal associate of Lord Chaitanya. Your glance of mercy can purify hundreds of arrogant sannyasis like me. Please be merciful to me. The saintly sannyasi was not experienced in the relationships amongst devotees. Still, he could see the relationship of the guru and paramaguru, and he did act in the way a sincere disciple should to his spiritual master. Then, after seeing the sandhya aruti, the two of them returned to Sri Godruma. After some days had passed in this way, the saintly sannyasi desired to learn the spiritual truth from the Paramahamsa Babaji. Except for his garments, the sannyasi had become like the Vaishnavas, controlling his mind and senses and filled with a host of virtues. He had full faith in the spiritual path. In addition to that, he was very humble, and he now had faith in the transcendental pastimes of the Supreme Lord. One morning at sunrise, the Paramahamsa Babaji sat in his cottage of Madhavi vines and chanted his rounds on Tulsi beads. As he remembered the Lord's pastimes of leaving Vrindavan, tears flowed again and again from his eyes. Now aware of his original spiritual form and forgetful of his external material body, he became engaged in a service appropriate for that time of mourning. Approaching, saintly sannyasi could see that the Babaji was plunged in an ecstatic trance. Staring at the sannyasi, the Paramahamsa Babaji said, O gopi friend, please silence that monkey, so he will not break the happy sleeping of our Radha Govinda. If they awaken, then our friend Lalita will be very unhappy, and she will rebuke me. Look, Ananga Manjari is signaling that it be done. You are Ramana Manjari. This is the service given to you. Please be careful and attentive. Speaking again and again in this way, the Paramahamsa Babaji finally became unconscious. Now understanding his identity in the spiritual world, the saintly sannyasi became engaged in those services. Then the sun rose, and the beauty of dawn became manifested. The birds sang, gentle breezes blew. The morning sunlight made the cottage of Madhavi vines very beautiful, beautiful beyond description. The Paramahamsa Babaji was sitting on a seat made from banana bark. Gradually, he regained external consciousness. Then he continued to chant the holy names. At that time, the saintly sannyasi offered dandavat obeisances to the feet of the Babaji, humbly sat down beside him and said, O Master, this lowly person has a question. Please answer his question and make his burning life cool and happy. Burning life cool and happy again. Please sprinkle the nectar of Braja on his heart, a heart burned by the fire of impersonalism. The Babaji replied, You are qualified to hear answers. Please ask your question, and I will reply as I am able. The sannyasi said, O Master, for many days I have heard about religion. I have asked many people about the truth of religion. Sad to say, their answers were not in harmony with each other. Therefore, I ask, what is the true duty of the individual soul? Why do different teachers give different explanations of the true religion? There is only one truth. Why do the philosophers not agree in their opinions? So up to this point, we see that the place has been established of Gaudrum, its position, its transcendental, you know, specialty of being the most wonderful place in the whole universe. And that this place is Nandagaon. So then, after establishing the place, then the personalities in this pastime, then the Babaji, then Prajumna the Brahmachari, and the sannyasi are then introduced. So you see, Prajumna Brahmachari, he is the eternal associate of the Lord. He is the one who made the path the Lord Chaitanya went when he was going towards Vrindavan. He made all the nice trees and gardens and everything by his meditation. And he was he was called Nisinga Brahmachari because he was a devotee of Lord Nisinga. Then the Babaji, we see he's very qualified. And the sannyasi also, it'll come up also a little bit later, that he is from a Brahmin family. He is very, well-trained. He's learned all the different scriptures. He's studied all the six philosophies. And he's been very well situated in this. He went on his pilgrimages. He did all his different duties. It came from the Hamsa to Paramahamsa stage. So we can see that they're all very qualified. And in this qualification, this is where everything is happening, is that this proper culture is very important. The philosophy has to be practiced. Then, generally in this world, then philosophy is taken as the highest. Action is less, philosophy is greater. Or some who are very practical, they'll say action is more important, what's the use of the philosophy? So you always get these two different opinions. One is for activities, one is for knowledge. But we see that there's a problem with both of these. Because the one, though it's very nice, the activities being done, it may get some results, but it doesn't have a strong direction. Because it's just the desire of the living entity. What they desire today, that's the direction they go. The other has great knowledge, but knowledge, unless it's applied, what is the use? So this becomes a problem for this. So the two have to be combined. This is a very important point, is that if we have the philosophy without the culture, then we don't get anything. We get speculation. And if we have the culture without the philosophy, we'll end up with sentiment. So this combination is very important. And we see in our life, if we don't combine the two, then the results are not very good. We don't get good results. We don't get a proper situation. So here we see the results are nicely combined. The sannyasi knows the importance of, he has a desire to obtain a goal. He's not just knowledge for knowledge's sake. He wants to actually come to conclusion. He wants to know something. And, you know, he's searching after something higher and higher. And then he's seen this when the Vaishnava came, and that he was experiencing a bliss beyond what he was experiencing in this Brahmananda. So you got a taste for that. Then we see that he knows how to behave, that he goes to the spiritual master and offers his obeisances. He knows how to behave. And he is not, you know, he's feeling shy when the spiritual master is offering obeisances in return. And then we see that he is, And then the spiritual master there is offering obeisances because he is very humble, and he is not feeling that he is the spiritual master, and he is always referring to his spiritual master. So this is the proper etiquette. So we see this etiquette is being followed by these personalities. So we see the advancement is also very quick. Some will describe that this Jiva Dharma, the advancement that's going on here, is accomplished over many, many, many lifetimes. But for the novel's sake and for our understanding, it's condensed into one lifetime. So if one can follow these principles and take them seriously, then the speed is attainable. And if one doesn't, then it may take many lifetimes to obtain. Point is, as you follow it in this way, you understand it in this way, practice it in this way, then the result comes very quickly. And because it's the natural position of the soul. And if one doesn't, it just takes that much longer. That's all. So both are there. So both aspects are important, that one does not become proud, so he understands that he is not so advanced, so it takes time. At the same time is that faith and hope is there, that enthusiasm, that the whole process can work very quickly. So that balances. Then we see that they are meeting Prajumna Brahmachari, and he is requesting that they one study from that the sannyasi study from the Babaji, Paramahamsa Babaji, and that, you know, he study these teachings of Jagannanda Pandit, Spandit Bharta, and hearing like this. So then, in this way, the sannyasi is then living for some time with the Babaji. He becomes fixed in his devotional activities. We notice that he's practicing, he's chanting, he becomes fixed. He takes up the Vaishnava qualities. With this, then he is then becomes qualified to start to understand the transcendental process. And in here, then we see then he is able to also. The spiritual master is understanding his position, and the disciple is also, then it is revealed to him his position in their service to the Supreme Lord. So those aspects are there. But we see after that, still all the different things to understand are there. It's not that one has some understanding of his relationship with Krishna, and without clearing out whatever anartas are there, one only absorbs himself in this knowledge or this activity. Because otherwise, it won't be pure. It will not be properly situated. It means the getting out of the material world or never forgetting Krishna is part, and always remembering Krishna or attracting oneself to the spiritual world. These have to be done side by side. Otherwise, it says that there is only one rule, right? And that one rule is always remember Krishna, never forget. So if you count, it's two. But these are counted as one. Because you cannot always remember Krishna if you're forgetting him. And to never forget Krishna means you have to remember him. So we'll only forget Krishna if we're attracted to the material world. Otherwise, something so attractive as Krishna, why we wouldn't remember? Because we have these side attractions in the material world. And so, but at the same time, is we get rid of the attractions to the material world. If we're not attracted to Krishna, then we'll also not have Krishna. We won't remember Krishna. You won't forget, but you won't remember either. So this is the Brahman. This is the liberated platform. So the sannyasi was developed in this way. So, but he has doubts because he doesn't know how to go beyond liberation. He's attracted by it, but still, he is having to remove these particular attractions or doubts within his mind. So therefore now they'll begin the process of study. And we'll see from now on then this first part then establish the story, establish the place and the different personalities involved. But we see it very much establish the culture. This culture is very, very important. Some will say it's not so important. Some will say, well, it's Indian culture. But what does that mean? You know, Prabhupada gave the example. What is it? It's a Bengali saying. Morahati lak taka. Means a dead elephant. Dead or alive, an elephant's worth a lakh of rupees. When it's alive, you can sell it because it's alive. You'll get a lakh of rupees. But when it dies, then you still get a lakh of rupees. But not for the live elephant, but for the tusks and bones and everything, because all the bone, everything's ivory. So the whole framework of it is valuable. So even though it may be dead, you know, it's just whatever you see now, it's still worth, because you can still learn from it, gain from it. Like that. So this idea, well, it's Indian culture, but what is India? What is that? We call it India. Westerners call it India. The name is Bharat Varsha. Bharat Varsha is mentioned in the scriptures. And the culture that is followed here is the culture that the whole world should follow. So that means, what is the culture? Not what the Indians have lost due to the Western influences. And due to the Western influences, therefore, they don't follow the culture. So what we call today Indian culture, which we say is not like the Vedic culture, is actually Indians trying to be Western. So then the glory does not come to the Western. You can't say, well, therefore, since Indian culture is just Indian, I'll follow the Western. Right? This doesn't work, because the reason we call the Vedic culture has become Indian culture is because of the influence of the Western. So if just some influence of it has ruined it, what if you take this ruining thing in its pure form? What will be the result? Right? If you have some nectar and you put a little bit of poison, and you'll say, oh, this is no good because it's poison, then the logical idea is therefore I won't take this, I'll just take this straight poison and I will get a good result. If I take this nectar that has some poison in it, I'll get a bad result. So therefore I will take the pure poison and I will get a wonderful result. So it's not a logical statement. So the idea is that it's not Indian culture, but maybe we have to distinguish between what is not properly practiced of the Vedic culture. What is? But that's there anywhere. You go to the West, and you can find all kinds of criminals and bad mentality. So we say that's Western culture. No, we'll say Western culture is, you know, proper morals and understandings and, you know, good standard of pranamoy, so, you know, the streets are clean and everything's in order and everybody's doing everything properly. So you'll say that's Western culture, but you can go all over the West and find so many examples, unlimited examples, that don't follow that. So do we say that's Western? No. So the same in India. It has to be applied. We have to be very careful that we don't use these things just to get out of following the Vedic culture, because it means having to restrain ourselves, having to direct ourselves, having to retrain ourselves. And that our training, our upbringing, our view on things may not be the best view. So this is important to understand. So these things are possible today. They can be followed exactly as they're being discussed here, because these are eternal principles. You know, yesterday fire was hot; it burns. 100 years ago, fire was hot, it burned. 500 years ago, 5,000, a million years, it was always hot, it burnt. So that is the nature of something, the actual dharma of something. So the culture is always valuable. One has to use one's intelligence to apply it. Because the culture is more than the external, the ritual. That's the thing. The sannyasi was very expert at all the rituals. He had studied all the scriptures. But he understood there was something more, something deeper. Therefore, then he came to this conclusion. So now they will start to discuss what is the actual understanding of religion, how to follow it, what is the proper. Otherwise, then one has a tendency to go one of two ways. Take the rule, and without understanding it, follow it very strictly, very fanatically, or throw out the rule, because it says it doesn't mean anything, doesn't apply today. So that is... Any questions on this? The sannyasi said, "O Master, for many days I have heard about religion. I have asked many people about the truth of religion. Sad to say, their answers were not in harmony with each other. Therefore, I ask, what is the true duty of the individual soul? Why do different teachers give different explanations of the truth of religion? If there is only one truth, why do the philosophers not agree in their opinions? Meditating on the feet of Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu, the saintly Babaji replied, O fortunate one, as far as my understanding allows, I will tell you the truth of religion. Please listen." Here's another point, is that as far as one understands, that is what is explained. One should never think that I understand everything, because Krishna is unlimited, so there's no chance of understanding everything. So as far as he understands, then he says, this is what I know, I will teach you that. More than this, then we don't know, we can't teach. And fortunate, because he's the disciple is also seen as fortunate, because they have this interest, they have this desire to know, and they have come to, you know, associate with devotees, follow the culture, follow the philosophy. So they're very fortunate. So then both are very pleased in each other's association, because both feel that they are getting, you know, association of those who are fortunate. O fortunate one, as far as my understanding allows, I will tell you the truth of religion. Please listen. The eternal nature of a thing is its eternal religion. The religion of something comes from its original identity. When Lord Krishna desires to create something, he creates its original nature. That original nature is its eternal religion. However, when a thing comes into contact with other things, its nature may become changed. After some days, that changed state becomes firmly established, and it seems to be the eternal nature of the thing. However, this changed nature is not in truth the real nature of the thing. These changed natures are called nisarga. I will give you an example of such a changed nature. Water has an original nature. The original nature of water is that it is liquid. However, in contact with certain circumstance, that nature becomes changed, and the form of liquid water may become solid ice. That is the changed nature of water, which seems to be its original nature. However, this changed nature is not eternal. It is always temporary. It is manifested for some reason. It remains for some time, and eventually it disappears of its own accord. On the other hand, the original nature of a thing is eternal. Even when the changed nature is manifested, the original nature remains, although it is dormant. In the course of time, when circumstances are favorable, the original nature is again openly manifested. The original nature of a thing is eternal. Its changed nature is temporary. One who knows the truth knows the difference between the eternal and the temporary nature. One who does not know the truth thinks the temporary nature is eternal. Okay. So we have to be able to distinguish between these two situations. You know, just like you have a child. The natural nature is, you know, they'll be you know, behave in their natural childish way. They'll have relationships or affection with their parents, and you know, they do things that the children do. Now, if the circumstances are not favorable for this, there's some change in this, then it may change their nature. They may, you know, have to become, you know, take up responsibilities too early, or they may become distrustful of others, or so many things may happen due to this change. So we may take that as that's the natural nature, because that's what we see. But this is not the actual thing. It may remain if the situation remains like that. But again, if you put it back to its natural position, then the natural nature will come back again. Well, it may take time. Like you have a block of ice, you put it in a warm place, then it will again go liquid, the water. But it won't happen immediately. It will take some time. It'll slowly go. So therefore, we have to be able to see this difference. This is a very important thing. The modern culture then takes it, they see today, that is the actual eternal nature. The living entity in this material world then is bewildered by two illusions, that everything is eternal and everything is full of happiness. So then in the position that they see today, whatever it is, whatever they take, whatever, they will take that this is the way it always is. Therefore, then they will make up their philosophies, their ideas, their values based on this. And this is what gives the difference between the Vedic and the modern. Is the Vedic deals with means the proper Vedic deals with the essence of the Vedic deals with the eternal nature of something. The temporary aspects of the Vedic will deal with the pious change nature of the object. And generally then the contemporary cultures, then they will deal with the impious nature, change nature of the object. So then we have to be able to distinguish between these if we want to be able to actually make a study of what's eternal and what is temporary. If we want to actually see natures, then we have to see this.
Change
nature would mean when an object, though it has a natural nature, comes in contact with another object that has an effect on it that changes it, like that. You know, just like water has a nature, but when it comes in contact with a situation that's cold, it changes. So therefore, it appears that that's like that. Like if you go to Antarctica, you know, then that's the way it is. It's just like that. But we see, you know, the ice is falling off, it's going somewhere, it's melting. So it's not the eternal nature, though it may be for a long time. So, in other words, the point is this: the living entity is conditioned. They have an original nature as servant of Krishna. But in contact with the material energy, they've been changed. And so that seems to be the eternal nature. You know, the enjoying spirit, the controlling spirit, all these different things. So, but that's not the real nature. The nature is something else, like that. So that, therefore, see, in other words, the question has been asked, why do different people talk about religion in different ways? And because they're looking at different aspects of the conditioned nature, right? Or just they're looking at a portion of the transcendental, of the original nature, just that the soul is eternal. So only the Vaishnavas can actually understand religion, because they understand all of the different aspects. They understand the actual eternal nature of the soul. So therefore, you'll find, it seems like there's so many religions. There's only one religion. But it's just a matter of what you are describing of that one religion. You know, what aspect you are talking about. So if you see the whole picture, that's the matured Vaishnava tradition. And if you see part of it, then it will be either an immature vision or a vision by that's affected by the conditioned nature. So according to desire, you will see a different part of it. You're attracted by a different aspect of it. And then that's all. You know, and so that's all you know. And then, right time. So,
yes.
Any
questions on this? Just on what the difference between the eternal and the temporary nature of things. Yes.
How do we see someone's conditioned nature as they get, say, fully purified? In one sense, that conditioning comes out as the conditioned nature, but it's a fully purified state. What gets left behind and what carries on? Not looking at their eternal spiritual identity, but in terms of their material conditioning, that in that lifetime they're practicing sadhana bhakti, getting fully purified. What's that manifestation then? That's just the purified conditioned nature. How do we see that? It's an eternal...
Could you give an example?
Somebody comes with a particular kind of set of conditioning into the material world, and by the process of sadhana bhakti, by the end of that lifetime, they will have given up the unwanted aspects of that conditioned nature, but still it's manifest in a particular way that's different from someone else. It's got its individuality.
Mm.
But it's purified. Not looking at the eternal swarup, but as it's manifest in a material, external sense. What is that?
Well, the reason it's all individual is because every individual is different. So even their approach to the material world is going to be, you know, different. Say their particular identities and desires was going to be different. You know, minutely unique. So that's because each individual soul is different. So therefore you have that aspect. Then in purifying, then as long as one is basically embodied, then until what's called vastu siddhi, then Krishna doesn't remove all of the prarabdha karma. Because if he does, no body or, you know, mind or intelligence to work with, right? Because that is a result of one's previous activities. Therefore, it has to remain. So one will just see it in its purified condition. Because when you engage it in Krishna's service, then it is transcendental. So there, it has to remain. Because if it completely goes away, then they'll... Because until you've attained your spiritual form, and it is complete, then there's always going to be some tinge of materiality there. If you're 90% spiritual, still that means 10% is material. Like that, as we see the gopis, when they were, those that did not get the association Nityasiddha gopis, they, even though they had a spiritual form, they're in Vrindavan, they've taken birth in Vrindavan, and that, and they're part of the spiritual pastimes, transcendental pastimes, still there was some touch of materiality there. And it was then burned up when in their separation from Krishna, when they couldn't go to Krishna. But then, in that, then it becomes completely spiritualized. Right. So then, so it's a transformation. So that was given up. So that, therefore, it said it was that they left their bodies or gave up their bodies. But they gave up that material aspect of it. But the spiritual remained. So they didn't die. Some will say they died. They didn't die. They just, what was material of their form, you know, and the consciousness went. That was given up. But the spiritual aspect, then that remained. You know, and that became what was then the manifest. So these things are going on at once. It's very important to be able to understand two things that seem to be contradictory happening at the same time, same place. You know, in the same situation. Because then one can understand, you know, our philosophy and understand the pastimes like that. Otherwise, it's much more difficult like that. So the form will have to be there like that, but it's there, and it will be being purified as one goes along like that. So that's not the problem. One should see what's the good parts. Then one will always maintain enthused. If one will find something, some fault or some material aspect, you know, if it's not a necessity, then it will simply be a disturbance. But if one sees the other side, then it's good. Does that make sense? Sannyasi asked, "You speak of a thing, vastu. What does this word mean?" The Paramahamsa replied, "The word vastu is derived from the word vas, to exist, and the affix tu. Therefore, that which exists is called vastu. There are two kinds of vastus, things that exist in reality and things that do not exist in reality. What exists in reality are spiritual truths and the spiritual goal of life. What does not exist in reality are material objects, material qualities, and the like. What exists in reality exists in truth. What does not exist in reality exists only in someone's mistaken belief. When a person believes something, it may be that what he believes is the truth, or it may be that it is only an illusion. Srimad Bhagavatam 112, it is said, Vedyam Vastava Matra Vastu Shivadam. The highest truth is reality, distinguished from illusion, for the welfare of all. In this way, it is proved that the world of spirit is the true reality. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the only reality. From him, the many individual spirit souls, who are all his parts and parcels, are manifested. And from him, also the potency of illusion, Maya, is also manifested. Therefore, the word thing, vastu, may be applied to three things. 1, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. 2, the individual spirit souls. And 3, the illusory potency, Maya. These three things exist in reality. Knowledge of the relationships that exist between these three things is said to be pure knowledge. And so this is what's called Sambandha Gyan. That understanding these three and their relationships, this is the basis of knowledge. It means from that, everything else can progress. Because otherwise, one doesn't have a strong, one doesn't really know what's going on. You may have the sentiment to want to do something. So in the beginning, that's okay. And that's good that that sentiment is there. And it should remain and grow. But if one doesn't understand the relationships between things, how are we going to be sure that we're always going to act properly? Otherwise, the tendency may be, is in our sentiment, we may do anything. Right? Sentiment is there today, it may be applied properly today, due to our sincerity and that, and so Krishna arranges that it works, just like the sannyasi. He didn't know Vaishnav etiquettes. He knew etiquette, you know, basic Vedic etiquette, but he didn't know the finer aspects of the Vaishnav etiquette. But when he met the spiritual master, other spiritual master, then he was behaving very properly and offering his obeisances and, you know, properly dealing. That's because of his sincerity. But if we become a little proud of our good, you know, abilities and good fortune, then that insincerity then may get in our way, and then we may do all kinds of strange things. In the name of religion, in the name of, you know, spirituality. Therefore, one has to know this Sambandha Gyan. It has to be cultivated along with. Then you know who you are, who is God, what is the material energy, what is the relationship. So that is important, the Sambandha Gyan. What is the relationship between my hand and Krishna? My hand and myself? You know, what's the floor in Krishna, floor in myself? You know? Or the floor in, you know, the floor in Krishna. You know, right? So you have to understand all these things. As we understand, then we're able to act. Otherwise, we may do all kinds of things that may or may not be proper according to the philosophy or the culture. It means it's wrong with the culture, it means it's actually wrong with the philosophy. What's wrong with the philosophy, it will naturally be wrong in the culture. We have a tendency not to do properly. So these three things, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the individual spirit souls, and the illusory potency Maya, these actually exist. The Mayavadis will say, none of these, there's only Brahman, there's only one thing that exists. The Vaishnavas understand that there are three things that exist. But the illusion is that we do not understand these three and what is their relationship. Like that. Does that make sense? Any questions? No. It means he's taking step by step, so these things will be the basis of future discussions. So if this so in other words, yeah, by not understanding these relationships, we have ideas about something, who we are, or what is God, what is this material energy. And so that creates the illusion, because we create the illusion. Like that. The thing exists, but what it actually is, that's another thing. You know, what it is in reality. Reality means in its relationship with the Lord. That's the reality of the thing. Okay. Continuing here. There are many different conceptions of the true natures of these three things. These conceptions tend to be full of errors. The Vaisheshika philosophers, in their categorization of things and qualities, believe to be true many things that are not true. Things that exist and true have specific attributes. These attributes determine their nature. The individual spirit soul exists in truth. The individual spirit souls have specific attributes that are eternal. These determine the natures of the individual souls. Okay, so here he's saying that the different philosophies, the reason they give different ideas, because they understand these three things differently. They have their own ideas of what is the soul, or there is no soul. Like Vaisheshika, his idea is everything comes from matter. All there is atoms. So there is the atom, and then you put a lot of atoms together, then you get something. You get a chair or a table like this. And then you can take the chair or table apart back into its atoms. So that much is correct. But he thinks that's the basis of everything. He doesn't know that the atoms have come from somewhere, and that there's a soul inside the living body, therefore it's acting. So it's like the modern scientists. So they have their own idea about this, the relationships of sambandhagyan. So they don't really know what they're talking about. Therefore it's illusion. Therefore, the different persons, as they talk about religion, they give different answers, because they're in illusion. They don't know how to distinguish matter from spirit. Then the saintly sannyasi said, "O Master, I yearn to understand this properly." Then the saintly Babaji said, "A devotee named Krishnadas Kaviraj, who has received the mercy of Lord Nityananda, showed me a manuscript of a book he had written, a book named Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. In that book, Madhya 20, 108 and 117, Sri Mahaprabhu gives this instruction. Jivir surupoi krishner nityadas, krishner tatasta shakti beda bheda prakash. It is the living entity's constitutional position to be an eternal servant of Krishna, because he is the marginal energy of Krishna, and a manifestation simultaneously one and different from the Lord. Krishna buli se jiva anadi bahirmuk ata eva maya tare deya samsara duk. Forgetting Krishna, the living entity has been attracted by the external feature from time immemorial. Therefore, the illusory energy, maya, gives him all kinds of misery in this material existence, in his material existence. Lord Krishna is the totality of spiritual existence. He is like a sun from which many spiritual universes have come. The individual spirit souls are rays of light from that Krishna sun. There are many individual spirit souls. Someone may say, "You say that the individual spirit souls are parts of Lord Krishna. This means that when he is broken up to become the individual spirit souls, Krishna ceases to exist. This is like a mountain that is broken up into many parts. When it is broken in this way, the mountain ceases to exist." To this I reply, "You cannot speak in that way." If my opponent then protests, "Why not?" Then I reply, "From Lord Krishna, limitless individual souls are manifested as parts and parcels. Still, Lord Krishna is not diminished even slightly because of that. In all the Vedas it is said that the individual souls are like sparks emanating from the blazing fire of Lord Krishna. However, none of these comparisons gives a completely accurate picture of the real truth. The examples of the great fire and the spark, the sun and the ray of light, and the alchemist's stone and gold do not describe the entire situation. Therefore, rejecting these material analogies, one should look inside his heart, and there he will understand the truth of the soul's nature. Lord Krishna is the great spiritual being, and the living soul is the infinitesimal spiritual being. Lord Krishna and the individual soul are one in the sense that they are both spiritual. However, Lord Krishna is the complete whole, and the individual wholes are only parts of the whole. That is the difference between them. Lord Krishna is the supreme master eternally, and the individual spirit soul is his servant eternally. In this way, their natures are described. Lord Krishna is the supreme attractive, and the individual soul is attracted to him. Lord Krishna is the supreme controller, and the individual spirit soul is controlled by him. Lord Krishna sees all, and the individual spirit soul is observed by him. Lord Krishna is perfect, and the individual soul is poor and lowly. Lord Krishna is all-powerful, and the individual soul is powerless. Therefore, the eternal nature or religion of the individual soul is to be a faithful servant of Lord Krishna eternally. Krishna being the whole, meaning he's the whole including the living entities. So even though they're separated, he still includes them. Otherwise, how is he the whole? If you have a mountain and you take it apart, like they give the example, then that means the mountain is not the whole. Because as you separate the individual rocks, it disappears. So the mountain isn't the whole. So if it's the whole, it means you can separate all the rocks and the mountain's still there. That means it's the whole. But the individual rocks are individual rocks. So the individual souls are individual. But Krishna is the whole. You can separate unlimited living entities, and still he's the complete whole. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purna Purnamudachyate. So it's as you separate, he stays the same. Because he is the whole. So that means he's outside of all that. So even though they're separated, he's still bigger than that. So even though they're separated, they're still within him. It's just a matter of whether they're manifest or we can understand it or not. But otherwise, he is bigger than the biggest. Otherwise, how is Mother Jashoda not able to put the rope around Krishna? How she can put a rope around the cosmic manifestation? It's not possible. So that is the point. Therefore, he says you have to look within oneself. There has to be faith. There has to be some understanding that God exists. Then he will reveal this. Otherwise, on our own, our intelligence, if we are limited, then that means our intelligence is limited. Okay. So the material intelligence cannot understand.
And aren't you saying looking within means shari,
talking
faith?
Yeah, basically. It means one has to observe the spirit soul. So here he sees that means we look at it, then all these qualities, Krishna is great, he's very small, he's powerful, and the living entity is not, he's powerless. No. Krishna is perfect, living entity is not. So its duty is serving Krishna. That's its natural position. That's the natural. Krishna is attractive, the living entity is attracted to Krishna. Right? Means that's all there is in this world, is Krishna. So the living entity is attracted to this material energy, because Krishna has entered it. But the living entity, due to his lack of proper understanding, takes the material world to be what's attractive. So that's the illusion. Material energy is not attractive. It's dead matter. So there's nothing attractive about it. But we see Krishna in the material energy. We are attracted by Krishna in that form. And we think it is that what we are seeing, that that's what's attractive. Like we have a flower. Flower is attractive. Why? Because Krishna is all beautiful. So some of his beauty has been empowered in that flower. So we see the flower, we're attracted. What we're attracted by is Krishna's beauty that has entered that flower, but we think it's the flower. But it's not. So that's the illusion, that we think the flower is beautiful because it is something on its own. But it's beautiful because Krishna has entered it. So that potency of Krishna has entered the flower, therefore it's beautiful. Krishna's potency of like strength has entered a rock or a pillar, therefore it's strong. Like that, Krishna's potency of intelligence may have entered a living entity, therefore we say they're very intelligent. But it's not the person's intelligence, it's Krishna's, it's his potency. So that's the difficulty, is that in this world, then we mistake what is there as something else, Maya, that which is not. So it's Krishna. Right. There, yeah. Therefore, then we deal with it as Krishna is, wants us to deal with it. Therefore the Vedic culture and all the rules and regulations. Because we're attracted by Krishna in that particular form of the material energy. So what we're attracted to is Krishna. So now Krishna in that form wants to be dealt with in a proper way. That's the culture. That's the rules. Right? So we have to deal with Krishna in that way. So therefore, you know, the flower is beautiful. So it can be used in the way of beauty. So therefore it's used for decorating, it's the, you know, these kind of things. That's how we deal with it. Krishna's potency of power is not there, so therefore we don't take the rose and then put it on the foundation of the house and think that that will hold up the house. No, we will take a brick or a rock, because that has that potency of Krishna's strength. We will put that at the foundation of the house. Right? So we have to, in other words, it's the way that we're dealing with Krishna, but through the energy in which he's manifesting it. Is this understood? Yeah.
I'm trying to understand what purity actually means. You're saying that the contamination is illusion. And then you speak of a platform called Brahma Bhuta, where the living entity is above the modes of material nature. So what's the remaining contamination between that platform and the
Swaroop
becomes manifest?
Well, the Brahma Bhuta and Swaroop basically are manifest around the same time. It means then one can actually, even though it's just like here, the sannyasi may understand what is that, but how much he can operate it, that's another thing. So one has to come to that. Here, if it's mentioned he's Paramahamsa, so it would appear that he is on the Brahma Bhuta platform, so then maybe he's able to operate it. You know, just like we know that we're servant of Krishna, but we're not operating it necessarily so nicely. As we become purified, we may understand more of what that means. You know, now we have an idea that we want to serve Krishna in the realm of Vrindavan. So that makes it more specific of us as servants. We're servants of Krishna, but so are all the living entities and all realms. But within the realms, we want to serve within Vrindavan. Right? So then that becomes more clear. So, means the, how do you say? Okay, another aspect then. The sixth of the means you have all the aspects of Shraddha Prema. Those are manifest from the beginning all the way to the end. The Shraddha there in the beginning, but its most mature state is Prema. That is where the maturity of that faith is reposed. Or the association of devotees, that is the fullest manifest on the platform of prema. Because then one really knows how to associate. Bhajana Kriya, the following the proper activities, that's the most perfectly manifest in prema. So all stages in between, all of these are manifest. So then in Anartha, then it has six aspects. So the sixth of them is, though one is getting proper results, one is attached to those results. To, you know, enjoy something oneself from them. So we see that the living entity may be on that platform. that Brahma-Buddha platform, and the result of that is the spiritual facilities that come. Right? It means the living entities are there in Braja Vrindavan, in the Lord's eternal pastimes. But they are very happy with the lifestyle that's there. Right? So there's still some attraction, but it's not to the material. It's to the spiritual. So they're actually kind of, in a very subtle way, wanting to enjoy or take advantage of the facilities of the spiritual world. So there, you know, they have very, very nice, I mean, Vrindavan is the nicest place. You know, wonderful cows and wonderful homes and everything's the most wonderful. But there's some attraction, you know, in following all those activities of the household ashram. So therefore they get attached to the children, they get attached to their duties, get attached to so many things. They're spiritual things that they're getting attached to, but they're not getting attached to them in the actual proper way. So we see that that's still that aspect of what's it, Taranga Rangini. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that aspect is there, even though it's on that such high platform. But we're talking something very different than on the lower platform when we're talking about in Anartha Nivritti. You know, when we call the stage of Anartha Nivritti, before Nishta, is that you're talking about gross things there. You know, it's like, you know, some facilities come. Let's say one has a position. So with that position goes, let's say, an office and some facilities and a car and a place to stay. So we get attached to those things and we try to enjoy those things. So that's the grosser manifestation of that. So here is, along with this, you know, our conditioned nature is dealing with these. Now here they're beyond that, but still they haven't developed their love for Krishna, always remembering Krishna. So they're becoming distracted by that. You know what I'm saying? Therefore, when one crosses prema, then one is completely situated. One can't fall from there. Because then one is just fully in love with Krishna, fully going towards Krishna. There is no distraction. But before that, there may be some. So even a spiritual, even they're in a practically spiritual form, you know, and in spiritual situation, everything's spiritual, but they're still attracted to enjoy that. In a sense, so there's still that touch. This will come up later, I think in the next chapters. The touch that I am enjoyer. Therefore, the point of I am servant is always being driven in. We may say, oh, that's a basic point, I already know that. Yes, we intellectually know that, but if we realized it, it would completely change our whole, the material existence for us would disappear, simply with this one thing. Is in the mind, if you take out I am enjoyer and put in I am servant, and therefore that's how you accept and reject anything, then you'd be a pure unalloyed devotee. But because we still have the idea that I am enjoyer in that spot, therefore we're going to see, accept and reject everything based on I am enjoyer. So it's good for me, not good for me. You know? And therefore they do their household duties, oh, it's very good for me, it's very nice. I get a nice, you know, pious situation, it's nice. Everybody deals with me nicely. Yeah. Like this. So therefore it's very subtle like that. Because here it's more gross, and there it goes up to subtle. But the idea is we understand these principles so that we're always aware of them. That's why you can have somebody who's very advanced and they'll be saying, I'm very fallen. Because they're very aware of these, so they see maybe the smallest, slightest thing, which for us is nothing, but for them may be very great. So this. Any other questions? Therefore, the eternal nature or religion of the individual soul is to be a faithful servant of Lord Krishna eternally. So there he's concluded what is the actual religion based on the eternal religion. Lord Krishna is the master of limitless potencies. All these potencies are perfectly manifested in the spiritual world. For the manifestation of the individual souls, one particular potency, the Tathasta Shakti, is employed. The imperfect material universes are also manifested by one of the Lord's potencies. That is the same potency called Tathasta Shakti. This potency creates a world where spiritual beings and inanimate matter stay together in the same realm. In this way, it creates a kind of relationship between the spiritual world and the material world. Spirit, which is conscious and pure, and matter, which is inanimate, are opposites. Therefore, it is not really possible for the conscious spirit soul to have a relationship with unconscious and inanimate matter. The individual soul is a small particle of spirit. Nevertheless, one of the Supreme Lord's potencies makes some individual souls somehow have a relationship with matter. The potency that does this is called Tathasta Shakti. The place that exists between a river's water and the dry land is called Tata, shore. Such a place touches both land and water. In that place between land and water, the attributes of both land and water are manifested. The individual soul is spiritual. Nevertheless, a spiritual soul may be placed under the control of inanimate matter. Thus, the living soul is not like the spiritual world, which never comes into contact with the material world, nor is the individual soul like inanimate matter. In this sense, the individual soul is neither spirit nor matter. That is why it is true that the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the individual spirit souls are different beings eternally. The living entities are Tathasta Shakti. So they're in between the spiritual and the material. There's something that has they can be influenced by both. So therefore the principle is always given of iron and fire. It's when the iron is in the fire, it's like fire. So if the living entity is always in the fire of the internal potency, it's like the internal potency. Like that. So it's considered non-different. But if it's not in that fire, then it's not. You know, it will take on the qualities of Maya. It won't be something separate. It means So therefore, the Lord and the living entities are eternally different. That's the point that is being made here, from that aspect. It means there are points that are made that are tattva, that help us understand the relationship and break us away from matter, or break us away from improper understandings, you know, of the Lord or the material energy of ourself. So this is one of those. Then there are those ones that bring together. Right? Here is how to distinguish between them. And that is necessary to break something. It means if we take something apart, it loses its attractiveness. Like you may have some nice, like we have, you know, this nice computer. And then if we take it apart and spread it all over this room and point out each little part, it loses its attractiveness. You know, you take a nice, nice car. You know, it looks very attractive and nice, and we take it all apart down to every last nut and bolt and put it all out. It loses that attractiveness. So that's the whole thing, is we take this material world and all these different things that we're used to dealing with and take it completely apart down to all its little components, so we lose the attraction. But that's not enough. That's just what the Mayavadis, the impersonalists, do, is they just break it apart until it loses its attraction. But the other side is that this is the I'll never forget Krishna. You know, because we break apart the material world so that we give up the material world. Then there's the we have to become attracted to Krishna. That's why then, along with this side, there must be the cultivation of the attraction to Krishna. Right? So therefore we see Bhagavad Gita is there and Krishna book is there. Bhagavad Gita breaks us away from the material world. Krishna book attracts us to the transcendental. to Krishna. So that these two go together. So we don't forget, one is so that we remember. So these points are being made to make that point, and that's what they're for. They shouldn't be used otherwise.
So it's
sambandha gyan
that's used for attraction.
Basically, yeah, it's there. Sambandha gyan is it's to create the basis for the attraction. But its main thing is to make us understand our position in the material world, Krishna's position, so that we give up our false understanding, like that. So it's more to establish the proper religion and to make that basis of relationship, create an attraction for Krishna. But it has a dual function. It breaks us away from the material world, loses the attraction this side, and attracts us towards Krishna, right? But the actually drawing towards Krishna, the attachment to Krishna, that's another thing, that's the prayojan. Right?
Sometimes we see that some devotees are very much cultivated this sambandha gyan, and then they kind of drift away. Because there's not so much.
There's no taste. It means the knowledge is. This is what is called. This is the meaning of the jigyasu. They're inquisitive. They intellectually are interested. So they're intelligent and hear something interesting. So they check into it and it looks nice and they may get very involved in it and all that. But as soon as that kind of intellectual thing is done, then they move on to another intellectual. So, because the taste is not there, and it must move. See, intelligence is coming from passion, so it must move. It must be engaged. It must create some activity. It must do something. So that's the thing. So unless the mind is attracted, right? So therefore, we'll say the heart. That's in the mode of goodness. That can last. That can be steady. But just attracting only in the intelligence can't be studied because it's coming from passion. So that's an important point. Therefore, it's always that point of remember Krishna and not forget. Right? So the mind is actually, we're using the intelligence to control and get the mind to remember Krishna. Because the mind is attracted by so many other things, so we have to use the intelligence that being attracted to material things is not good. So in this way we control. Therefore the intelligence is considered the controlling factor. It is the controller of the situation, control of the senses, because the senses are coming out of passion also. So the intelligence is controlling the mind, therefore the senses are controlled. So it'll say be said that the intelligence is the higher principle. But what one is trying to do is get the mind to be attracted to Krishna. Because once that happens, then without the intelligence, one is just attracted and drawn to Krishna. It's not an intellectual thing anymore. Then it's the actual desire. Because desire is the main thing. So the intelligence, its function is to control the mind when it's not properly engaged. But when the mind is properly engaged, then the intelligence doesn't, on the mundane platform, act has no function. That's why it says, not by gyan can you get bhakti. It simply makes it favorable so that the mind can get the proper association and become attracted to Krishna. If it's always doing nonsense, it'll continue its attraction there. But if it's controlled by the intelligence, then one does things. One chants, one associates with devotees, one sees the festivals, one takes prasad. And in those situations, one may appreciate the taste of the name, of the prasad, of the service to the devotees, service to the deity, you know, the benefits of the dham, the glories of the dham. So then the mind gets attracted by those. And then that's what you're trying to get. It's not just the intellectual. That's why sometimes it's thought, oh, you study everything, know everything, and then that makes the advancement. No, that's very helpful for the advancement, but that itself is not the real test of advancement. In the beginning it may be, because one is becoming steady. Right? But that steady in one's sadhana and these kind of things, and understanding the philosophy. But the real thing is the positive side, right? It means you have to get out of the negative, you know, to the neutral point to get to the positive. So steadiness means the neutral point. But the real advancement is when that taste comes. The mind likes to do this. It likes to chant. It likes to worship the deity. It likes to live in the Dhamma. It likes to associate with devotees. It likes to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. Then that's something solid. That's the taste, right? Therefore, nama ruchi, right? That's the third of the important aspects. You have to have a taste. So jiva doya is there. So you're understanding the position, explaining to others, bringing up the preaching, the sambandha gyan, establishing relationships. But in that relationship, there should be a taste. Therefore, nama ruchi. There's no taste, what's the meaning of the relationship? There should be a taste for that. If you say you have a relationship with somebody, there must be something live there, some taste. You just say a relationship and there's no taste, it means it's not really a relationship. Relationship means taste will come. So if there's attraction, if there's understanding of the relationship, there's attraction. And if there's attraction, there'll be attachment. And then, if there's attachment, then you're going to do something. Right? So therefore, Vaishnava Seva. Right? In the association of devotees, one's going to serve the Lord. So that was time. Otherwise it gets late. We will all turn into pumpkins. Srila Prabhupada ki, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki, Samavita Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nithai Gaur.